My name is Dr. Christopher Exley, formerly Professor of Bio and Organic Chemistry at Keele University, where I spent nearly 30 years researching the role of aluminium in living things and, most recently, the role of aluminium in humans and what we call human exposure to aluminium.
Can you tell us something about what brought you to that topic? I mean, it could have been almost anything, any substance, but why aluminium and why Keele?
No, it's a great question. Let me just say that I'm not advertising here, but during the first lockdown of COVID, I wrote a book. It's called Imagine You Are an Aluminium Atom: Discussions with Mr. Aluminium. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is I spent the previous 29 years answering these questions over and over and over again on email. And I always answered every single email. I thought, look, it's time to put something down in one particular volume. So the question you ask is really, it's a big question. I'm going to give a very short answer. The short answer is that I went to the University of Stirling to do a degree in biology in 1981. And as part of my final year there, it's a 4-year degree at Stirling, I had to think of something to do. And there was a famous part of the university called the Institute of Aquaculture. And I went there and talking to someone, I decided to do a project looking at acid rain and why acid rain was killing salmon. And that's where I started. So I started to look at why, and this is, remember, we're in the mid-80s, and the subject of acid rain was actually very topical, but we didn't really understand why fish were dying in rivers, why trees were dying in forests. And I identified potentially aluminium as a culprit and started to do experiments on it. And I guess from that moment onwards, I caught the bug because I went on then to do a PhD in more or less the same subject area. I want to make it clear. I went to Stirling simply because I knew I could go fishing there a lot. It had its own trout loch and there was loads of great fishing around. I love fishing. But am I a fish biologist? No, I am not. So very quickly in my work with fish, I began to ask the question, well, if this is what aluminium is doing to fish, what is it doing to everything else, including humans? And very quickly, I moved on to think about generally what is the role of aluminium in living things and potentially what happens if things go wrong.
Well, I suppose the obvious place to start looking at aluminium is what role does it naturally have and should it have in the human body?
Yeah, so this is the wonderful story of why I spent 30 years on the same subject. Because aluminium, which is the third most abundant element of the Earth's crust and the most abundant metal, has absolutely no biological function in any organism, either an organism that used to live and has died out or is living today. So this is a fantastic paradox because usually abundant elements and particularly abundant metals do have biological functions. And one of the things we tried to look at was say, well, look, is this because the role of aluminium in biology has been selected out of biology? And the answer seems to be no. There's no evidence at all that aluminium has ever played a beneficial role in any living thing. So this created a wonderful question for me, and that's why I stayed within the subject for the last 30 years or so, 40
Couldn't
years
it
now.
be, Chris, with the nature of science that maybe we just simply yet haven't understood what role aluminium plays in the body? Not that it has no role at all.
Yes, you're absolutely right. This is the nature of science. Obviously, myself and many others, the interest in aluminium in living things is about 100 years old. Coincidentally, it sort of matches the period when man learned how to take aluminium ores from the earth and create aluminium metal and aluminium salts. and what I call the advent of the aluminium age. So it's not that we haven't been trying to find the role that it plays. Now, that doesn't mean that sometime in the future, someone will find that role. You're right. There may be some thing that we have missed that I have missed. But you know what? I call my book Imagine You're an Aluminium Atom because that's how I've worked for the last 30 years. And when I imagine I am an aluminium atom, I never am able to imagine a role for aluminium in the majority of living things. Now, that doesn't mean to say that those roles may not evolve in the future, because the difference between, let's say, aluminium and oxygen is that when oxygen first appeared on the Earth, it also was totally toxic. But those things that were able to deal with oxygen, live with oxygen, deal with its toxicity, the things that metabolize oxygen, like you and I, they survived and everything else died off. Now, what may be happening now with what I would call, again, the advent of the aluminium age, a really big increase in the biological availability of aluminium, is that, yes, we are now evolving in the presence of increasing amounts of aluminium in our everyday life. And yes, some organisms may find a role for it that we will discover in the future.
Okay, so given that, I wonder how long has aluminium been out there in the environment? Does it go back to prehistoric times? And what routes that it might enter the body? Obviously, the first is, you know, by maybe ingesting it into your gut, breathing it in, some sort of aluminium dust or possibly even a vapor or whatever. And then once it gets into your body, there is also this other, the blood-brain barrier, another important barrier to stop it getting into your brain. Because I know that certainly over the last few years, there have been hints that it plays aluminium plays quite an important role in certain types of Alzheimer's potentially. So these two barriers to stop it getting into the body, how has it been getting in, Chris, and for how long?
So, yeah, to answer the how long bit first, as part of the celebration back in 2009, I think it was, a part of the celebrations of the 200 years since the birth of Darwin, I was asked by a biochemical journal called Trends in Biochemical Sciences to explain, if I could, the role of aluminium in living things using Darwinian natural selection. And that is actually the way in which I have actually approached this subject all along, in that you need to start to say, well, when did aluminium in any significant amounts become biologically available such that living things would take it up? And my conclusion to that really was that, based on everything that I know and the research obviously that we'd done, that process has only happened relatively recently. And certainly in terms of human beings, it's only since, as I mentioned earlier, the advent of the aluminium age and us using aluminium widely in our everyday lives. So that's the end of the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. So very, very recently. So next question is, when it is available or when it is more available, is it getting in? Well, yes, of course it's getting in. I mean, it killed the fish. And, you know, you might think, well, I'm not a fish. Well, actually, you're not so different to a fish, and you're not so different to a plant. And in fact, you're not so different to any other living thing in respect of the way in which chemicals interact with you. Now, how did aluminium get into the body? Again, this is a big chapter in the book, but and we don't know which is the most important route, but clearly via the gut is important. And as you mentioned, breathing is very important because your lung is a huge surface area that collects particles from the air. Your nose is also very important because that connects to the olfactory system, which connects directly to the brain. your skin is actually probably permeable too, and almost certainly is. And we know this from studies, for example, using aluminium-based antiperspirants. So you are, in many ways, your exposure to aluminium occurs over a number of different routes. Now, it is also true, because if we measure the products of excretion of the body, such as the urine or the feces, or the different sort of things like sweat, etc., that the body produces, we also know that aluminium comes out of the body. So that also tells us that aluminium gets in. And in some respects, this sort of information has been a red herring to many, many people looking at and researching this area, because they sort of make the assumption that because aluminium is getting out, that there is some sort of processes to remove it. It's not true. These are completely adventitious. Because aluminium is brand new to human biochemistry, there are no aluminium specific processes known at all. So whether it gets in and how it gets out, it's totally by some sort of random, chaotic, adventitious type processes, which are usually related to the fact that aluminium shares some chemical similarities to other metals and other elements. And so it piggybacks upon those systems. So, yes, and, you know, people love to talk about the blood-brain barrier as if it's like some sort of mythical thing, you know, the guards there and saying, you will not enter. You know, the blood-brain barrier is something I had to lecture on over many years at Keele University. And one of the things I used to tell the students almost immediately was, you know, one of the main properties of the blood-brain barrier is something called residual leakiness. And you can guess what that might mean. It means that stuff leaks over the barrier all the time in both directions. But what the blood-brain barrier is famous for really is that it is more selective than other barriers. It is able, because of the way in which it's constructed, to have less leakiness, and also to be able to, if something goes across, perhaps be able to remove it. So it's less permeable than, for example, you know, your gut obviously needs to be permeable, otherwise you very quickly die, you get no nutrition, etc. But the gut and the blood-brain barrier are ostensibly exactly the same types of cells. It's just their organization is a little bit different. And so one allows, you know, in both cases, you've got selective permeation of necessary things. And in others, it's also the ability to put things back across that barrier that's important. And that's the blood-brain barrier. So, you know, one should, everything that goes into your blood can get across the blood-brain barrier and does do.
Okay, so you seem to be hinting, Chris, that really there is no mechanism to get aluminium out of the body, which is a little bit worrying once it's in there. And I suppose the obvious corollary of that is that maybe something like fasting might, you know, because you're emptying many, many things from your body when you're fasting, they're being processed, they're going out of your body, mostly through your urine, that may be a way of getting it out or not. Do we know?
I don't know whether anyone has specifically looked at fasting, but we have looked at ways in which the body gets rid, inverted commas, or which aluminium gets out of the body. We've done an awful lot of work with respect to urine, and we've done a smaller amount of work with respect to perspiration. And so, for example, perspiration could be a major route. It could be the major route whereby aluminium leaves the body. And it's an interesting area because, so for example, in men and women have about the half the basal perspiration level as men. So women might be predisposed in that respect to accumulating more aluminium in their tissues. Is this the reason why women are more predisposed to aluminium-related diseases like Alzheimer's? Maybe it is. So another interesting one with respect to perspiration is that things like exercise, you're going to sweat more. So you will get rid of more aluminium. Or if you use the sauna, you will get rid of more aluminium. And in both of these cases, these are two ways to protect against diseases like Alzheimer's disease. Could be just complete coincidence.
The common sense answer here then seems pretty clearly to just make sure it doesn't get in there in the first place for whatever reason. Treat it like any kind of toxic chemical. Just steer well clear. Make sure it goes nowhere near the mouth or the nose. You know, basically keep it well away. But anyway, look, before we get into this idea that aluminium is particularly harmful, can you just give us evidence that it does accumulate in the body, whereabouts and what damage it can cause?
Sure. Well, I mean, there is, you know, hundreds of scientific papers looking at this specifically. You can start off, as many do, looking using animal models of this, and it will be found in those circumstances in the usual places. It will be found in the liver, it will be found in the kidney, it can be found in the heart tissue, it is certainly found in bone. It is found in the brain. Now, we in my group, particularly over the last 10 or 15 years, we have concentrated on human brains and human brain tissue. We have, I really don't know what the number is now, but we've probably looked at more than 200 human brains. And obviously those brains, we then look at specific areas of them, and we always find aluminium in brain tissue, regardless of health of the individual. But we do find different amounts, but we always find aluminium in human brain tissue. And to a certain extent, what we really expect is for aluminium is that once it gets inside the body and we know it's removed. We know it goes out in the urine. We know it goes out in the sweat. We know these are chance-like processes. But if it goes into something where the particular tissue is, for example, very long-lived, it can sit there and it could accumulate there. So you ask the question, so where are the long-lived areas, the tissues of the body? And the bone would be included in that. And we know that aluminium actually is a cause of certain types of bone disease. And when we look at the bone in that, we see aluminium almost like the tree, almost like tree rings that you see it. You see it in particular places in the bone. But of course, the other long-lived tissue of the body, or at least the long-lived cells of the body, are the neurons of the brain, which it live for the your life on the earth. So they are very, very long lived and they accumulate aluminium slowly but surely over time. So one of the first things that not only my group but others showed was that there tended to be an accumulation of aluminium in these types of tissues, like brain tissues, with age. So we expect someone who is in their 60s, 70s and 80s to have more aluminium in their brain tissue than someone in their teens, for example. And generally, that is what we have found in our research. So we are finding exceptions depending upon certain conditions and physiology.
Okay, but what about damage and effects of this aluminium and evidence that it's harmful?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we know that aluminium is harmful, and we know that it's harmful to the brain, because in the 70s and through into the 80s, people on dialysis started to get a brain disorder. It looked like they were actually going mad, and we had to try and sort this out. It was called dialysis-related encephalopathy. People on dialysis were dying, actually, of something which looked like it was sending them mad. And what we learned very quickly was that one of the reasons was that aluminium that was in the tap water that was going through the dialysis machine was going straight into the body and into the brains of these people. And so those that were unfortunate enough to die were able to look into the brain and find huge amounts of aluminium. But we know that when aluminium gets into the brain, it causes an encephalopathy. An encephalopathy meaning an accelerated massive loss of cells, neurons in a particular region, or sometimes over the whole brain. So we, you know, there are myriad animal studies showing aluminium toxicity. So aluminium toxicity per se is not, no one argues against that. Of course, when the arguments come in is with respect to humans. And so the argument would be, yeah, but dialysis encephalopathy, this is really just a one-off situation where huge amounts of aluminium get into the brain and cause this condition. And so I guess part of what we've been then looking to do is we'll say, well, look, aluminium is neurotoxic. No one argues against that. So what's the threshold? What's the point at which an acute response like you get in dialysis encephalopathy, in which someone could die within very few days of receiving dialysis treatment, versus someone who is receiving a steady input of aluminium over, for example, decades, accumulating in their brain tissue? Is there a threshold whereby all of a sudden that aluminium also starts to produce neurotoxicity? And that's the type of thing we've investigated.
Well, look, a few years ago, I was chatting to a woman who was the editor of the Alzheimer's Journal based in Bristol. And she was saying to me that they were looking at an epidemic of Alzheimer's. I mean, is there any absolute clear proof that Alzheimer's is caused by aluminium, Chris?
This has been a question for me since I started to look at this. And I started to look at specifically aluminium and Alzheimer's in the early 90s. And we've worked on it almost exclusively in humans since then. And it wasn't until I wrote a paper almost like an editorial piece for the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease Reports in 2017, but I said that I now know that we have enough evidence to say that aluminium is a cause of Alzheimer's disease. In fact, I could go so far as saying if there was no aluminium in the human brain, you would not get Alzheimer's disease within the normal longevity of a person into their 90s and 100s. So I am saying that aluminium is a cause. It doesn't mean it's the only cause, but when aluminium accumulates in brain tissue above a certain level, it is already impacting on the function of your brain. It is already killing neurons. It is already taking you down that path towards Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, it took me a long time to come, you know, out of the closet and say, right, I'll put my whole reputation on the line now and say that this is the case.
Can you just give us a brief, without getting too bogged down in scientific jargon, how you actually go about detecting aluminium in tissue? So the actual evidence that you've got in front of you as a scientist looking at this saying, ah, right, here, aluminium, it may be a slice of brain tissue that you're examining.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, yes, we work with brain banks, usually within the United Kingdom, but sometimes we work with brain banks outside of the United Kingdom who provide us with brain tissue, human brain tissue. And one of the things that has been used in the past as a criticism of this type of work is that you're only measuring contamination. Contamination that comes into the tissue because of everything that you're doing with it. So we've had to work extremely hard in making sure of the provenance of both the tissue and every single step that we take before we're able to then do the measurement on the tissue itself. And we published a paper in 2012, I think it is now, a seminal paper going through these procedures in more detail than anyone has ever done before on 100 human brains. And we made a, not only did we measure the aluminium content, but we repeated the processes with no brain tissue in the process. In other words, we did what we call method blanks. We said, well, look, if aluminium is getting into this system somewhere, then we should be able to measure it as part of a contamination process. And that's exactly what we found. We did find contamination. And to the extent that we are able to have, then have a value that we can subtract from any of the real values that we produce. So this study that we published in the journal called Metalomics in 2012, Housatel, this has not been criticized. This is the way to measure aluminium in human brain tissue, and my group is recognized worldwide for being absolutely the best in doing that, in that you can believe what we produce. And, you know, what's more important is that I believe the data that we produce. And I need the very best controls possible if I'm going to stand up and say aluminium is a contributor or a cause of Alzheimer's. So then what we would do is, and for example, a study we published in 2020, part of a group of studies, but one, we have found aluminium in brain tissue from autism, brain tissue in multiple sclerosis, brain tissue in sporadic Alzheimer's disease, the normal form of the disease, brain tissue from familial Alzheimer's disease, which is the early form of Alzheimer's disease. But what we've also found is we've taken, working with the Brain Bank in London, control brain tissue. In other words, my colleague, who is the lead neuropathologist at the Brain Bank in London, has chosen brain tissues where there is absolutely no neurodegeneration, no evidence of neurological dysfunction in the donor, and said, look, let's measure these too. And that's what we've done. And you know what? They're very low in aluminium, very low, but we still find it. But they are significantly, statistically significantly lower than in all the others. So we're able to go, if nothing else, we can say that in certain conditions, certain diseases, aluminium is significantly elevated in human brain tissue. And in some of those, like familial Alzheimer's disease, like autism, the amount of aluminium is very significantly elevated.
Okay, so look, given this, I think you've made a pretty good case, actually, that we don't want this stuff in our body. It's a material which is out there. I think probably one of the largest uses of aluminium is possibly in the aviation business. It's a very strong metal, but very light. But it's also used in the kitchen in our pans. So I can remember many years ago being told by someone, one of my roommates when I was living down in Southampton, actually, oh, don't use a stainless steel stirrer in an aluminium pan. Otherwise, you're eating the aluminium from the pan. But I mean, maybe you could just run us through some of the basic practical ways, Chris, that we can keep aluminium out of our food and out of our diet.
Yeah. So quickly, first of all, the old style aluminium pans should not be used full stop. You know, the ones that are almost are slightly soft, the metal is slightly soft, it's malleable almost. These should not be used any longer. And indeed, you try and buy one, you can't. It's very, very difficult. They're still used, of course, in hospitals, still used in school canteens. But you try and buy one on the high street, you can't. What you can buy is what's called anodized aluminium. Now, that has a much more inert surface, and so therefore is nowhere near as bad with respect to the release of aluminium. But you still shouldn't cook anything acidic in these, because that will very quickly remove the aluminium from those. So, you know, let me answer a different question for you. So you've noticed probably that every now and then I've been taking a sip of water. It's not any ordinary water, to be absolutely frank with you. This is a water that is rich in the element silicon. Silicic acid is the dissolved form of silicon in water. Why do I prefer to drink a silicon-rich mineral water? Well, because right back at the beginning of my research looking at aluminium toxicity in fish, I showed that silicon protected against aluminium toxicity in fish. And in the paper we published in Nature, we threw away the statement, maybe it does so in humans. And you know what? It does. And we have followed up that. We've done clinical studies in people with Alzheimer's disease. We've done clinical studies in people with multiple sclerosis. We've done it in healthy controls. Regular drinking of a silicon-rich mineral water facilitates the removal of aluminium in your urine. So you drink silicon-rich mineral water and all of a sudden the aluminium in your urine is huge. But if you do that consistently, it starts to go down, showing that you're actually removing aluminium from your body. You know, I've said many times, no one knows much more about aluminium than I do on this earth, but I cannot avoid aluminium in my everyday life. I cannot completely avoid it, but I can take measures to both reduce my how much I come across it, but also help to remove it. So I do this. It's a precaution. It's not like a classic detox. It's almost like a philosophy. This is a way in which I know that even though I am subject to exposure to aluminium, that I can at least hopefully prevent its accumulation in my brain tissue over whatever life I have left so that I don't get some of the more severe manifestations of aluminium toxicity, such as Alzheimer's disease.
This is almost a terrible thing to advise Mr. Aluminium to do, but get rid of your anodized aluminium pans and get some stainless steel ones, Chris.
Yeah, well, I have done. I didn't say that I use them. I said that you can use them because they will not be release as much aluminium. You're absolutely right. Listen, where I can, I don't eat any processed food rich in aluminium. I don't drink processed drinks rich in aluminium. I take almost no medications because aluminium is found in so many of them. So I do take precautions. You know, I grow all my own vegetables and things like this. I do take other precautions simply out of my knowledge of what I know I can do. And also it's my lifestyle, of course. You need to feed. You've got to live. People need to live. There are certain things they want to do regardless. And if you want to do some things regardless and they have aluminium in them, take a silicon-rich mineral water every day. Every day, a liter a day, every single day, and do it for the rest of your life. Silicon-rich, anything over 30 milligrams per liter, written as silica on the bottle. There's no silica in there. This is a strange anomaly of the water industry. But you know, this is a way in which you can provide that protection yourself. Because one thing I've always said is, no government is going to help you. The government is never going to even suggest that aluminium is bad for you. Not since I've been alive and not, I think, in the foreseeable future. The aluminium industry is so powerful. It's unbelievably powerful. If a government conceded that aluminium had a role in Alzheimer's disease, you know, stock markets around the world would crash. We would see something, actually even worse than the tyranny of COVID in terms of the way in which it would affect everything and everyone on the planet. So I don't think they're going to let that happen. In fact, you know, we might not have time to talk about it, but the reason I'm now forced into retirement is probably because, you know what, Chris, you are probably right. And you have worked your entire life and you have come to the conclusion that aluminium has a role in human disease and specifically, for example, Alzheimer's disease. And your research is making such incredible advances in this, being published in high esteem journals, that it's got to be stopped. You know what? They've stopped it. That's what they've done.
I mean, this pharmaceutical lobby is a bit like something like the City of London or the arms lobby. They're incredibly powerful. And for many people, viewers and listeners watching TV, listening to the radio, reading newspapers, I don't think quite realise how powerful they are. But look, you slightly evaded my question about aluminium in water, because I can remember this is, I think, back in the 1990s, something called the Camelford water disaster. Am I right in thinking that that aluminium was involved in that? Because it does concern me. I mean, I was looking recently at the government's present attempts to force fluoride into our water supplies. Obviously, that's something which is a kind of medical treatment, supposedly for your teeth. But if you look up fluoride, you'll find that there are some people say that is another neurotoxin. The last thing we want is to be able is to be getting toxified with aluminium and fluoride every time we take a sip of water. I suppose it might be good for the bottled spring water industry, but certainly not good for poor people who have to simply drink whatever they're given. So can you just say something a little bit about whether Camelford back in the 90s, which several people died very quickly and many people died prematurely as a result of there was something put into the water in Camelford, whether that was aluminium related and also whether there is aluminium in our ordinary tap water today.
Okay, so yes, I am the person who published the paper showing that a lady called Carol Cross in Camelford died because of huge amounts of aluminium in her brain with the neuropathologist Margaret Assiri. So we published this in 2006. And we have gone on to publish three or four other papers relating to people from Camelford and their brain tissues. The only brain tissues ever made available to anyone we have worked on and published on. And in every case, including one, for example, which was an adult onset epilepsy, we showed huge amounts of aluminium in the brain tissue. So this is one of the great, I mean, I write about this extensively in my book. The Camelford is one of the great government cover-ups. Of course it is, totally.
It's particularly shocking, Chris, because it was only literally, I think it was just a matter of a few months after the water had been privatised in Britain. So the various water boards that were publicly run, publicly managed, where you or I could actually go down and watch the proceedings of the board deciding what they were going to do with the water in that area, suddenly became privatised and whisked away. In fact, many of them, of course, now foreign owned. But that was almost, it happened almost immediately after Margaret Thatcher privatised the water.
Well, no, Camelford is 1988. So it happened just as we were privatising. Just. So, yes, you have guessed very quickly the reason why we had a cover up. You're right. But Camelford is a special case. There was a huge amount of aluminium put into the tap water. So we're talking about a value over 3 to 4,000 times higher than would be allowed under EU legislation. So the next question you wanted to know is, well, what about tap water per se, didn't you? I don't worry about tap water per se, even though aluminium is used to clean tap water today. I think that they have got this process relatively well under control. Where they haven't, we need it investigated and changed. But generally, your exposure to aluminium in tap water is significantly less than almost everything else that you do. So your exposure through other routes that we have talked about a little bit is much, much greater than you would normally get today through tap water. And you know what? The authorities, even though they're privatized, are extremely sensitive about aluminium in tap water as well. Very sensitive. So there have been occasions that I've heard about recently where, because they have got their processes wrong, something happened in when they've been using it in the cleaning process so that the amount of aluminium going to the domestic user has gone up, where they have told people to stop using the water and provided them with mineral water. And this is nothing like Camelford. This is just a small increases above the EU legislative amount. So, you know, the interesting thing, you're bringing up water. And of course, we think about, I talked about silicon being important, and silicon is present in all of our drinking water. But, you know, one of the really sort of academic areas of my research has been the chemistry of aluminium and silicon. Some people think I'm a chemist, and they often, Wikipedia thinks I'm a chemist. All sorts of people think I'm a chemist. I'm a biologist, but you need chemistry to learn biology sometimes. And some of the chemistry that we have learned is now in the textbooks, and that's the reaction of aluminium with silicon in the context of living things. And this was not known before we did our work, or at least it wasn't recognized as such. Most science is known, of course, it's how it's recognized and taken on further. So we've shown that in order for silicon to bind aluminium, and for example, to help to remove it from the body, you need a lot of silicon. You need a high concentration of silicic acid. Otherwise, the complex that's formed is relatively unstable and will fall apart almost immediately. So we've done this chemistry. It's been beautifully published. And so that's why we say it has to be a silicon-rich mineral wood. But interestingly, in some parts of the world, so take France, for example, in certain areas of France, they do have natural potable waters that are rich in silicon. And epidemiology has shown that in those areas, the risk of Alzheimer's disease is 4 or 5 times less, not because of the amount of aluminium that's in the water or even the amount of aluminium that people are exposed to, but because of the high level of silicon. So high level of silicon in natural potable waters does protect against the instance of Alzheimer's.
Well, I mean, these are all very important facts that you're sharing with us here, Chris. I wonder if you could just say something about, you know, the pushback by the industry, by the industry, against this information getting out to the public. Because I think for most people, you know, you're one of the few people who's actually witnessed this in action.
Yeah, well, right from the start, we've always had issues, put it that way. We have always been confronted by problems relating to the power of the aluminium industry. It's, you know, for someone like me, it has always been more difficult to get a grant than somebody working in a, let's say, on copper. In fact, it's 10 times more difficult. But generally, up until a certain point, I mean, I've, you know, been in academia for over 30 years. For the first 20 years or so, I was tolerated, I think. I was successful. I brought in significant amounts of research funding, upwards of £6 million during my time at Keele. And the majority of that through established funders. But that became more and more and more difficult. And it didn't become more and more difficult because the subject is declining and no one's interested. It's because I think we're making progress and and they don't like this. And they have their fingers in every single established system that we have. I mean, government supports the industry, nothing else. Government supports the aluminium industry. So where it's government funding, we have zero chance of getting anything. We research aluminium toxicity in humans. That's why we had to rely in the last sort of 5 years, definitely, and 10 years overall on philanthropic services. We started to look at ways in which we could get philanthropy to help us out. And we're very successful. We brought in about £1 million over about the last 7 or 8 years. And that kept us going. Without that philanthropy, without those donations, we would not survive. And of course, this is what Keele did to me. Keele decided that I was no longer able to accept philanthropic donations of any sort, including charities.
Okay, so Chris, so say, for example, if I wanted to support your work, I imagine I could go on to some sort of portal at Keele and say, well, I would like to donate, maybe £200-300 or maybe even more to Chris's work. So for a while working and yes. Is it still working?
No. Well, for starters, I'm not at Keele. but secondly, that's what they decided to do. We were so successful in getting, private donations were important, such as you've just said, but mainly through organizations that were either charities or essentially philanthropic services. Philanthropists who join organizations that mete out money to different types of causes and things like that. And so we were bringing in, I had a wonderful group. We were three permanent scientists and others associated with that. But I needed about £200,000 a year to keep my group running. And I could just about generate that through donations and philanthropic donations. And so that, if that is removed, which is what Keel decided to do, you know, on lies essentially, then what am I to do? I could have got, they didn't sack me. I had to leave. I had to leave because if I went back, I would be spending 85, 90% of my time simply doing lecturing and bureaucracy, and I would have no money for research. And my life has been about research right from the very beginning. I've enjoyed all the other academics. I've enjoyed lecturing. I've enjoyed taking that. Perhaps not enjoyed the bureaucracy so much, but I've enjoyed those aspects of it, and I had no problem doing it, but I don't want to be spending the latter part of my academic life doing that. Not for me.
So how did the Keele University principal, vice principal, or whatever, break that news to you that you were no longer going to be able to accept money from outside the university?
By email. I received an email to say that they have decided, and this came after an article in the Guardian newspaper, which made the suggestion, well, that in some way or other, I was deceiving people into making funds, into making donations to support anti-vaccine science.
Oh, okay.
Now, whoa, anti-vaccine science. Look, you know, we've had an established website for 25, 30 years. Where is the anti-vaccine science? We're scientists. We publish in the most highly respected journals through peer review, et cetera, et cetera. Where are we anti-vaccine? But that made no difference. So even though, you see, when they told me that I'm no longer going to be able to receive any funding from, you know, found charities, individual donations, philanthropic services, they didn't mention anything in that to do with vaccines. They mentioned the fact that we've just reviewed our procedures for people getting grants and decided that you are not going to be able to get grants via these. You can still apply to the government for money, of course, and, you know, that's fine, but you will not be allowed. And this only applied to me at Keel, no one else.
Well, it sounds to me like constructive dismissal, I think we used to call that sort of thing. So making it impossible for you to actually do your job.
That's absolutely right. And that was an option that my lawyers and I looked at, going to a tribunal, etc.
Well, I mean, you've mentioning vaccines there. I mean, did this happen then during the COVID situation? Because I know there's been a lot of, I mean, even before COVID happened, there was a tremendous amount of concern about the possibility that aluminium might be in vaccines. So first of all, maybe you could tell us if there is aluminium in vaccines, and if so, why it's there, is it justified? You know, maybe that, because that might be potentially a link to, you know, this Guardian article, et cetera, and you losing your research grants.
Yeah, listen, for the last 10 years, we have been researching the role of aluminium in vaccines as one of our main subject areas. The other one I told you about already is brain, aluminium in brain tissue, human brain tissue. So yes, aluminium is used in the majority of vaccines given to all of us, including children. It is there as something called an adjuvant. The reason it's there, you know, it's a totally financial reason. So for example, a vaccine works by adding or injecting an antigen, and that antigen is supposed to then give you a mild form of the disease, which then in the future will help to protect you against that disease. Some vaccines, some used today, they use what are called live vaccine. They use the actual disease to produce that response, that mild response. But the majority take part of the virus or bacteria, whatever it is that causes the disease, and they use that as the sort of stimulus for the immune system. Now, if they only used what's called the attenuated, the essentially dead part of the pathogen, and didn't use an adjuvant with it, the body would not respond to it. In other words, they use an adjuvant to create a response. And part of that response is then that the body also responds to the antigen that it wouldn't normally have responded to. Now, why am I saying this is a cost-effective exercise? Simply because, first of all, you could make an antigen work, but you'd have to put some investment and time into it. You could make it work by adding more of it, but the antigen is by far the most expensive part of a vaccine. Every other part is very, very minimal in terms of its overall cost. And the aluminium adjuvant, the aluminium salt that's included with a vaccine, is a fraction of a penny of the total cost of every individual vaccine. So if an individual vaccine is £500, which is about right for some, it will be one pence for the aluminium adjuvant. But you leave that one pence of aluminium adjuvant out, and the vaccine doesn't work. It gives absolutely no response whatsoever. So it's about, if you've got to, and particularly where you want to do mass vaccination means that you will need lots and lots and lots and lots of antigen. So how can you make that lots and lots and lots of antigen last longer, go through more people? You use an adjuvant for that process. And aluminium adjuvants have proved to be fantastically successful. But our role has been to say, well, why are they successful and how do they work? And we started to make some real progress on this, real progress. And we published all of that again in high quality journals, showing the way in which aluminium adjuvants work.
The question is, could they use something else other than aluminium?
Well, it's a good question. Of course it is. And they have done in the past, and they have stopped using those. So, for example, they did use calcium salts for a while, not aluminium salts, but these were nowhere near as effective. They still do use some other adjuvants that aren't aluminium-based. These are usually lipid-based. And again, they're a little bit more expensive than aluminium, but they are used. And sometimes you have a combination of adjuvants where you have an aluminium adjuvant and a lipid together. So, for example, in the now discontinued Cervarix vaccine, which was for HPV, used to contain both an aluminium salt and a lipid to work together to make the vaccine work. But that vaccine has now been discontinued, and Gardasil has taken over us. And that Gardasil uses only aluminium, high amount of aluminium to make it work. You know, it's about, if you are the vaccine manufacturer, you've got a choice here. You could spend a huge amount of money making a proper vaccine that doesn't require an aluminium adjuvant, that works beautifully, but costs the earth. Or you can have something that costs almost nothing. Which one are you going to do? There's no regulation to prevent you using aluminium. There's no regulation which enables anyone to come back to you because of aluminium-related problems or conditions that might result from using it. Which are you going to do? You are not going to choose the expensive route, and that's exactly what's happening. And one of the things about, a lot of people have asked me questions during COVID, of course, but the majority of the COVID vaccines in use today are not using adjuvants and not using aluminium adjuvants. However, many of the vaccines that are in development at the moment and are going through animal trials for COVID and COVID-related conditions are going back to the old technology, and they are using aluminium adjuvants. So again, you ask that. Yes, we made great progress in aluminium and Alzheimer's disease, but we also made great progress in telling people the reason an aluminium adjuvant works is because it's toxic. It produces toxicity, which the body responds to. And part of that toxicity is enabling the antigen also to become part of that immune system. Now, we've done, again, great progress in that area. And with the potential arrival of many future vaccines with even more aluminium in them, I think it's better to get Chris X and his team out of the way, don't you? I would do that. I would get rid of him. Because he's only going to cause his trouble.
Yes, but I'm afraid, Chris, you're not going away, are you? You're not one of those sort of people that would just bow out and retire without any effort to get the truth out to the public. I just wondered, how, if people are interested in supporting the sort of work you're doing, what might be the best way to do that? If people are interested in finding out more rather than less about aluminium's effect on health, particularly in the vaccine age.
Yeah, well, to be absolutely frank with you, right now we're not in a position to do anything at all. I am at home. I am actually drawing my pension. One of my team has another job. The other one who worked on the brain tissues is still looking for another job. It doesn't mean that, no, if there's a philanthropist out there, you know, when I knew that all of this was coming to an end, which was about 6 months ago, I put every bit of, you know, everything I knew out there to try and find someone to enable us to move from Kiel to somewhere else, to take the group elsewhere, either an independent lab, which would have been magnificent, or into another institution. Unfortunately, we just couldn't raise the funding required. If you want to move a group, everything that entails, and you can't just move it and, you know, with 6 months money, you need 3 to 5 years money. We're talking, you know, £2-3 million to move a group. If you want to build your own independent research institute, you're talking 10-15-20 million pounds. I wasn't able to raise that money. And so that's why right at the end, you know, we all stayed together, my team. We stayed together until the 31st of August. We made sure Kiel paid everybody right up until that day, just in case we're able to do something about it. It's still not impossible that we can do something about it, but it is really down to two things. One is financial might coming from somewhere, but also somewhere that will accept us, because Kiel are probably not alone in the way that they've acted against us. You know, the majority of British universities have been infiltrated by Bill and Melinda Gates and Gavi, and of course, the NHS. You know, one of the statements that is worth people reading. I mean, all of this is on my website. And if they want to read about why I've left Kiel, under the history tab on our website, I've got a very long statement, which, you know, if you can bear with it, you'll see, for example, as part of it, the university secretary, they're now called chief operating officers, but in our day, we called them secretaries, says in an email that I was able to get hold of, we can't risk a 10 million a year NIHR grant by keeping Exley here. So you can see that there are many different areas, that, including government. That's the government are influencing what universities do, their academic freedom, the ability to choose the research areas that you want. This is all being very heavily influenced by government. Government being influenced by, you know, Bill Gates and company and others who have this sort of power. Now, one of the things that I knew something was wrong was if you use Google, and in the past, if I Googled Chris Exley, I would literally get hundreds of thousands of hits of what we've done over the past nearly 40 years of research. And not only that, underneath at the bottom, it would say related searches. And it would say Chris Exley brain, Chris Exley this, Chris Exley vaccines, all sorts of stuff. Soon after I received the email from Kiel telling me that they were no longer going to accept the type of funding that I needed, if you then Google Chris Exley again, First of all, the number of hits went down hugely. But secondly, at the bottom of the list of related searches was things like Keele University's website, Keele University. There were nothing relating to me. In other words, I was being censored by Google. Now, once you're censored by Google, you know something is wrong. You probably have these experiences already. But you know
that. Hang on, Chris, though. What about tenure? This is something which is, the idea is that you are absolutely, as a professional researcher, academic, they can't fire you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the tenure bit is true to a certain extent. But most universities, I'll tell you what Keele has. Keele has a three hits and you're out. They can sack you if they take you to three disciplinary hearings in a year and find you guilty in all three. And tenure does not save you at all. That's a sort of I've been taken to so many of these things that I just knew to a certain extent that if I didn't leave Keele, they would find a way of doing that. So, for example, during COVID, I commented on an article in the Times Higher Ed. And my comment simply said, how come I can order birdseed considered essential by the government, and yet my research is closed down and has been for several months now? You know, where is the justice in that? Keele took me through a disciplinary hearing for bringing the university into disrepute and put that on my record. So that's how simple it is to get something on your record. And they only need three of those. They can be completely unrelated, but they'll find things. They always find things. And you're out anyway. But as my employment lawyer told me, actually, Keele can sack you at any time. You take them to a tribunal, you win, but you don't get your job back. You just get a certain amount of compensation.
Well, I think sometimes the tribunals can order that people get their jobs back, but then there's some sort of out-of-court settlement after that. Anyway, look, Chris, fascinating chatting with you. Wish you all the very best with your research continuing. But can you finish by just giving us the title of your book and where viewers and listeners can get hold of it?
It's called Imagine You Are an Aluminium Atom, Discussions with Mr. Aluminium. And there's a nice part in there as to why I am was known and maybe still am known as Mr. Aluminium.
Oh, I think you still are, Chris, actually. Yeah.
Well, I, as you said yourself, I am trying not to go away, but it has been, the story that I put on our website about, and I think you have read it, about why I had to leave Keele. Why hasn't a single journalist written that up? Why hasn't it been followed up? I had to fight through my lawyers to be able to use the information I had on this. They wanted me to have a non-disclosure agreement. I refused that. I only agreed to not talk about the agreement that I had with them for leaving. But in terms of what I knew already through my lawyers gaining information, no, I got information that showed that my vice chancellor lied to the Keele's University Governing Committee to get me removed, essentially. And that's not a story. What's happened?
Well, it is a story. It's the wrong story. That's what we used to call it in the newsroom. If someone comes up with something which goes against the grain and the establishment, then it could be the wrong story. Anyway, look, finally, your website, please, Chris. What is the website? Where can people get the book?
The website is mattmould.wixsite.com/aluminium.
Okay, I'll spell that. That's mattmould.wixsite.com/aluminium.
/aluminium. That's the website. And Matt Mould is the man who works with me on the brain tissues. Fantastic scientist. He set up the website. It's a say so myself. It's a fantastic website. One of the things that Keele did to us, apart from the funding, they disabled our website. So we said, well, what's going on? And they never brought it back. They said that in some way or other, again, not openly, they didn't say this, but in the emails that I received and found out about, that we were supporting anti-vaccine rhetoric through our website. Well, we've reproduced that website now for everyone to see. More or less every single thing is on it that was on it before. And everyone can have a look. Yeah. You know, this subject of anti-vaccine, I think it's entirely irrelevant whether you're anti-vaccine or not. Everyone has a choice of what they are. But if they look at what we have done, we have never done anything that is anti-vaccine. And the Vice Chancellor knows this, but he took advantage of the moment in time with COVID, etc., to convince a governing committee at Keele, who do not know me from Adam, that his actions were in the best interest of the university, and they agreed with him.
Well, I mean, I suppose the final question has to be, what now for academic freedom in the UK?
Is there any? I don't think there is. How many academics have spoken out about COVID? It's just not happening anymore, Tony.
Well, very few. I mean, I think there's Alison Pollock, who's a professor of, I think, public health up at Newcastle University. She called the COVID measures barbaric, I believe. I'm not sure if she's still got her job. No, anyway, there are a few.
I'd be highly surprised if she did. I mean, you know, my simple comment in the Times Higher Education Online questioning whether or not why you can buy birdseed and you can't have a research group working during lockdown, you know, that was enough for my university. So no one at Keele has ever questioned it. Of course, Keele is in bed with AstraZeneca. They are making the AstraZeneca vaccine at an organization called COBRA on the Keele campus. So you can see where the connections are there.
Well, it's certainly that it's a very embarrassing having somebody around like you explaining that, you know, that some part of the vaccine industry may not necessarily be 100% healthy. Anyway, Chris, I'll just remind viewers and listeners, it's Matt Mould, MATMOLD wixsite.com/aluminium. And thank you very much for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tony. It's good to meet at last.